What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. Adam and Josh are away this week. I'm Sam Van Halver.
Who's the black pride of dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Isaac Hayes' title track to 1971's Shaft. Shaft being probably the best-known film in that genre, known as blaxploitation. And back in 2012, Adam and Josh watched Shaft and five other films as part of their blaxploitation marathon. On today's show, we'll condense that six-week series into about an hour with reviews of Shaft, Superfly, and the Chicago-based Cooley High. Can you dig it? It's ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren, in for the vacationing Adam and Josh. We hit the gritty streets of 70s-era New York City and the slightly less gritty streets of Chicago this week as we look back at 2012's Blaxploitation Marathon. We'll revisit three reviews from the six-part series, and we'll hear how Adam and Josh wrapped up the marathon with their presentation of the Mayfields, the Blaxploitation Marathon Awards. Film Spotting Marathon started not long after the show itself launched in 2005. They were meant to help the hosts fill in gaps in their movie education. Genres like westerns, musicals, and horror have been subjects of marathons, as have the works of filmmakers like Ingmar Bergman, Pedro Almodovar. And in fact, the idea of doing a blaxploitation marathon had actually been kicked around since about 2005. It took the impending release of Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained to finally move blaxploitation past Bollywood and the films of John Cassavetes to the top of the ever-growing list of proposed marathons. A list of former marathons and future ones can be found at filmspotting.net. And now I'll shut my mouth, damn right, and turn it over to Adam and Josh and their review of 1971's Shaft.
Our last two marathons had a lot to offer, but I don't think any of the films of Robert Bresson or the examples of contemporary Iranian cinema we viewed had music anywhere as infectious as the Isaac Hayes title song for the first film in this marathon.
I'd like to see those hybrid movies, though.
Be interesting.
That'd be fun.
I think Shaft has the best music. But will these blaxploitation films have the substance to match? I think that's going to be a guiding question throughout this marathon. When are the films from this genre strictly about the style of their time? When do they also have lasting substance? And when might the style be the substance in terms of its social and political import? But let me dial it back a bit for Shaft and ask you a simpler but related question. Is Shaft more than the sum of the beats of its famous title song?
I think it is, though. Can I say that and still say that my favorite part of the movie is the title song?
Sure.
It is the title song, and it is everything about the opening credit sequence. I love the way it starts up on high, looking down on the New York City street, and then you see Shaft come out of the subway station, I believe, and that shot right there does seem to signal that Gordon Parks was maybe trying to send a little bit of a message as director, that there was going to be a certain type of production value to this film, a classical Hollywood aspiration that was maybe lacking in the film that was its precursor, and a lot of people see as really the movie that launched blaxploitation, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. And I brought that up because I do want to take a moment to acknowledge what a lot of listeners have noted, which is, how do you have a blaxploitation marathon without watching Sweet Sweetback?
Right.
Well, we considered it, but we have a couple reasons. One being, after our last two marathons where the films were kind of hard to find, we really wanted to make sure that all of these films were readily available. And all six of these movies are available via Netflix. Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, the Melvin Van Peebles movie, is not. We also wanted to find six movies that we both hadn't seen. You've seen Sweet Sweetback. I also feel like I have seen it because I've seen the Mario Van Peebles movie Badass, which is about the making of his father's film, and I've seen other documentaries about blaxploitation that certainly cover Sweet Sweetback. So I think I have some context to then go into a movie like Shaft. But to get back to that opening sequence, did it occur to you at all as you were watching Shaft walk down the street to that music that Parks may have deliberately had him walking by a lot of movie theaters?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of theater marquees where we're seeing names like Robert Redford on the marquee. And right away, it tells you that these are Hollywood's heroes. These are the white man's heroes. And now I've got a new hero, the new black hero, to introduce you to. I also love that everything you need to know about him as a character and a man is set up in those first 5 minutes or so. We learn that he carries a badge. We learn that he isn't going to take any crap from anybody on the street. We know that when a car stops short in front of him and almost hits him. And we know as well that he's going to be a friend to the working class or to the disenfranchised. There's a scene where he stops and talks to the blind newspaper vendor. So again, I think we can probably both agree that that opening sequence really is fantastic. And you're right, it's going to be a key question of this marathon, just as it was with our 70s sci-fi marathon, where there was a certain camp factor to those films, and you really had to wonder, okay, is this good almost because it's bad? I think that may come up with some of the movies here in this marathon, and I'm willing to view films like Shaft a little bit through the lens of its time. I think, though, to sum it up, this is a really entertaining film and an important one for ushering in that new black hero of cinema.
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. I think it's throwing down a gauntlet that we're not just going to have the Robert Redfords anymore. I'm glad you brought up that movie marquee touch, which is just a little touch.
It's not in
your face. I mean, it's just in the background as
Shaft is walking zooming along. Down.
But of course, it's purposeful. Really, the whole purpose of the film, as I saw it, was to establish Shaft as this powerful, independent, he's innately good but still kind of devilish character.
In it for himself a little bit.
Yep, and he's not beholden to anyone. He's not beholden to the cops.
That's key.
He's not beholden to the local mob boss. It doesn't matter if they're black or white. No one's going to hold any power over him. He's an independent hero. And this may sound obvious, and you could ask yourself, well, how is this different than any of the other movie heroes, the lone guns that we've seen since the beginning of film almost? Well, this is 1971 and he's black. That's how it's different. And I think it's dangerous to just set that aside because that's the true power of this film. And the film essentially worships him.
I mean,
almost every moment is geared toward holding him up. Again, in that opening sequence, the cars, he walks across, like, I think it's almost six lanes of traffic, and the cars have to stop for him. It's like they're bowing down to him.
And he owns New York.
He does. And there's even little subtle touches, as when he's getting his shoes shined. He's sitting in the chair, which is slightly elevated, as those chairs are. The camera's down below.
Yeah, it shoots up.
Pointing up at him in reverence. And there's this little thing, I don't even know if it was purposeful, but it feeds into this whole aura where he gets up and the camera kind of nervously stands with him and rises with him. You feel like you're in the court of a king in that scene.
You do.
And you're just in a shoeshine shop.
Now you got about a half a minute to tell me what the hell you want with me. Police gonna be up here asking why you threw that son of a bitch out the window. Now they can find you dead or alive. Now what's your goddamn story?
Bobby, said I was to bring you uptown.
Did he tell you to mess me up?
I said I was to bring you.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about Shaft, the opening film from our Blaxploitation Marathon. We've got five more to come over the next few months. And I think a key way that Gordon Parks shows us this new type of hero we're talking about is to very deliberately co-opt Hollywood conventions, specifically two types of heroes that everyone in 1971 would have been very familiar with. The first being the hard-boiled private detective, and the second being the super spy. And I'll get to the name you're all thinking of in a moment, but there are these abundant noir elements to this film. First of all, the complex plot, double crosses, people withholding information, using each other. There is a big sleep element to this movie. The desk in his office, the fact that he's a private eye.
Yep.
Who has an office, and when the kingpin, the drug kingpin in town, who has a lot of power and a lot of money, Bumpy, wants to hire him, and he's sitting in his chair, he tells him, you're sitting in my chair.
Right.
You're sitting in the private detective's chair. Cinema requires that I sit in that seat. So I love that. Also, you touch on his independence. His relationship with the law is also just like Sam Spade and other figures from hard-boiled private detective movies. He carries a badge. He knows some cops. He can work with some of them, but he is basically outside the law. He is a black Sam Spade, and the second half of the film shows us that he's also a little bit of a black James Bond. There's one point where he concocts this elaborate plan to get Bumpy's daughter back with makeshift bombs, and I think he jumps through a window at one point,
if I'm remembering. Silly.
I actually think those parts get a little too silly,
yeah.
And I wish there was more Sam Spade and less James Bond. And obviously, like both those characters, women can't keep their hands off him. So Parks is definitely deliberately working within the frameworks of spy movies and hard-boiled private detective movies. And earlier today, when I was writing down my notes, I did have to Google Shaft, James Bond influence, just to make sure I wasn't crazy, just to make sure that if I said this on air, people weren't going to write in and say, oh, come on, there's no way they were trying to pay any kind of homage or reference James Bond at all. But I wasn't surprised that the first link that came up was a link to the Wikipedia page for Shaft in Africa, which I think was the third film in the Shaft series. And they have a quote in there where Shaft is given his assignment and he says, now, wait a minute, I'm not James Bond, simply Sam Spade. So the movie is acknowledging those influences. And of course, as I've tried to argue, he really is a mixture of both.
You mentioned the women. Of course, that's a big part of the persona. And I thought it was interesting how even the sex scene, the first sex scene you get, focuses all on him. The woman is hardly a part of it, which is very different from how these Hollywood films usually go. But you even get a moment where they're going at it and the camera drifts away to a framed photo of Shaft on the bedside table
and
or something like that.
And he doesn't seduce her. He just lays there on the couch.
He's the one who's nude laying on the couch.
Yeah.
The camera focuses on his, and I think it's important, notably much darker skin, where she's kind of caressing his skin. It's all about Shaft in that scene as well.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that for black audiences at the time, it was empowering to go to a theater and see this representation of characters they'd seen on screen over and over again in Bond films, in detective movies, and then see a black hero who was every bit as macho and cool and tough as those white heroes Hollywood had been feeding them. And in some ways, this gets back to your point about his independence. Shaft is better than Bond, because if you think about it, Bond still has to report to someone. He still reports to M. He still works for the government. The man is giving James Bond orders. And one of the themes that runs throughout this movie is this notion of selling out, of selling your soul, compromising your integrity. And one major way you would do that is help the police get what they want. And he does work a little bit in tandem with Andrazi, I think his name is, this white detective. And at one point he says to him, Shaft, I'm not asking you to sell out. But Shaft knows that really is essentially what he's asking him to do, and Shaft recognizes that. And as I was watching the movie and thinking about the empowerment element to Shaft, that independence really is the key part of it, because by the end of the film, he uses the police to help him get the information he needs under the guise of working with them. He saves an innocent girl, reunites a father and daughter. He gets paid well. And in the final scene, after doing all that, he gets to tell the cops off.
Right.
That's the close of the film. He gets to tell the cops off. So he uses the system to his advantage. He walks away slightly injured, but otherwise his integrity is completely intact. He did it his way.
What's interesting about all that, though, is he unites the community in the process of doing that. He has the cops who he's using to a degree, yes, but he also has the gangster, the local gangster, and he has this Black Panther-like group that he teams up with. He's a man apart from all of these, but in a way, to rescue the kidnapped woman, he has to bring them all together. So he unites these forces in the community for this mission, and only the outside figure can do this. Now, of course, they're united against outsiders, the Italian mafia, who's coming in on their turf. So you could ask, well, maybe the enlightenment of the film ends there in demonizing another to unite this community.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how Shaft the man alone also serves as a uniter. And I want to touch back on what you talked about quickly here, empowering the audiences of the time. I think that's a huge part of the movie's importance and its legacy. Not only that, audiences took on this confidence as moviegoers, urban audiences where the film was a huge hit, but really filmmakers as well. Generations of filmmakers then took this on as proof that, okay, we can make our own movies, tell our own stories. And so you see that, you know, through all of the films that followed, some bad, some good through blaxploitation, but it's really why I do think this is a good place to start the marathon.
It makes me think of a line from the Isaac Julian documentary called Badass Cinema that is about blaxploitation, and I don't remember who the talking head is, and I'm just going to paraphrase it here, but someone being interviewed talks about perceived power. They talk about the Black Panthers at the time come out in this militant way and try to show you how powerful they are, even though the reality was nobody in Black America had any power at that time. I think that Shaft is the personification of that perceived power, and maybe that perceived power will eventually translate into real power.
Adam and Josh from their 2012 review of Shaft, the opening film from their six-week Blaxploitation marathon. When we come back, more great music, more great films. We'll hear the boys talk about their favorite film from the marathon and 1975's Cooley High, a film set right here on the near north side of Chicago. That's next on Film Spotting. Stay with us. How do I say goodbye to what we had? The good times that made us laugh outweigh the bad. I thought we'd get to see forever. So hard to say goodbye to yesterday. I don't know where this road is going. You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam and Josh are off this week. I'm Sam Van Halgren. For people of my generation, folks in their mid to late 30s, that song, It's So Hard to Say Goodbye, famously covered by Boys to Men in the early 90s, was the soundtrack to many a high school dance. But to our parents' generation, particularly African Americans who were in their teens and 20s in the mid-1970s, that song, performed by C.G. Cameron in the version you just heard, belongs to a different soundtrack, specifically the soundtrack to 1975's Coolie High. Based on writer Eric Monte's experience growing up in Chicago's Cabrini Green neighborhood, Coolie High is slightly lighter fare than its better-known blaxploitation cousins, Shaft and Superfly, and it was the fifth of six films in Film Spotting's 2012 Blaxploitation Marathon. We'll hear Adam and Josh discuss it later in the show. Right now, we'll get to a film that was probably the biggest and most pleasant surprise of the marathon, 1972's Superfly. I'm your mama, I'm your daddy, I'm that nigga in the alley. I'm your doctor when in need, want some coke, have some weed. You know me, I'm your friend, your main boy, thick and thin. I'm your pusher man.
I want to start our discussion of Superfly with this question of influence. Even more so than Shaft, Adam, I saw Superfly as a clear precursor to Tarantino's sensibility. I think we'd both agree that this has largely been a positive influence on Tarantino's work. Yet I also recognized elements of Superfly in other less encouraging forms of pop culture post-1972. Namely, many of the inferior misogynistic blaxploitation films that would follow, not to mention the materialistic strain of rap music that would flourish in the 1980s. I've talked before about how it's unfair when critics hold the likes of Star Wars and Jaws responsible for the soulless Hollywood blockbusters that came in their wake, claiming the Lucas Spielberg films themselves were worth less because of their influence. In your mind, Adam, does Superfly get a similarly bad rap? Is there more to the movie than the influential surface elements, the pimped-out car, the criminal lifestyle that some of its heirs have latched upon?
That's a great question. I thought, though, you were going to go the same direction you went with Shaft a couple weeks ago here in our marathon, where you were going to ask me about the music, because once again, it's amazing.
Oh, it's and so crucial, yeah.
It probably is, just like with Shaft and Isaac Hayes, my favorite part of the movie, but that isn't a slight on Superfly at all. The music just happens to be that good. I don't know that we're ever going to hear anything in this marathon better than Pusher Man, for example. Curtis Mayfield really is just such a talent. But in terms of your question, I don't really want to speculate on how it compares to its successors, because I just don't feel like I have much basis for where blaxploitation went after this. That's partly why we're doing the marathon, and I'm far from an expert on hip-hop in the 80s or 90s, but I do know that if this film is being written off by anyone then or now because they see it as glorifying the criminal lifestyle or it's just a surface-level film, then yes, it is getting a bad rap, because I think that is definitely unfair. And in fact, as much as we both liked Shaft a couple of weeks ago, I think this is a much more ambitious movie than Shaft was. That's not completely fair to say, actually, in defense of Shaft, because, of course, this was the movie that came later. And that was a movie made by Gordon Parks Sr. You had Melvin Van Peebles and his work. Other people paved the way for Gordon Parks Jr. here in Superfly. But I do think it's more ambitious because ultimately, as we discussed, Shaft was offering a new spin, a black spin, on familiar white heroes like Sam Spade and James Bond. So the filmmakers had something to work from and respond to, and it was bold and really entertaining. But Superfly offers, I think, an original black hero. He's a coke dealer, he's a pimp, he's getting rich off the vices of his own people. And sure, the movie gets to have its cake and eat it, too. We see all the cool elements of Shaft. This character Ron O'Neill plays, Priest Youngblood is his name. He's tough, he's smart, he's cool, he's a sex machine, and he beats Whitey at his own game. That's also a crucial part of the film. But at the same time, there is this element of social commentary where you have a character realizing that he's just been playing a hand he was dealt, and he's trying to break away from it. He's trying to get off the streets. I actually think the whole movie for me is summed up in a conversation he has with his girlfriend named Georgia when he tells her why he's getting out of the business.
What do you do when you get out?
I don't know. Not so much for what we do. It's having a choice. Being able to decide what it is I want. Not just to be forced into a thing because that's the way it is. Gonna buy me some time, baby. Some time that isn't all f***ed up with things we gotta do. Just to be free.
And will that make you happy?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know I can't be happy the way it is now. I never was.
Like we talked about with Shaft, a character who is always doing it his own way, is always being completely independent, even as he's straddling the white world and the black world. He's beholden to nobody, certainly nobody within the establishment. Here you have this character, Priest, who says all he wants is to have a choice. He just wants to be able to decide what it is he wants. He doesn't know what he wants, but he knows that he needs his freedom to make that decision for himself.
That's just one of the many introspective conversations that take place in this film. There's a lot of soul searching or just trying to figure out what Priest's identity is, who he wants to be. He seems to have independence. He has this drug business. He has money. He's outside of the law, yet at the same time, and he directly acknowledges this, he doesn't feel free. He still feels the pressure, and he feels like he's being used by various forces. And we find out towards the end how true that really is. I was struck by how sorrowful this movie is. And I guess that should have been clear to me, because when you sit back and really listen to the Curtis Mayfield music, it's not something that's, you know, full of joy or happiness or excitement, or where you think of the Shaft song, you know, which is kind of more along those lines. This is a
much
really
more playful,
sad music, and it echoes what's going on in this film, which is a lament. It's a lament about being in this community, having the one option for a young black man for success, which is illegal, selling drugs. The characters talk about this too, how it's a raw deal, but it's the only option they have. And yet even that in its own form is a trap. And it goes about all of this in a very non-moralistic way. There's never really any consideration of whether Priest is getting sick of this because he feels guilty. He's getting sick of it really because he realizes it's just another trap,
yeah,
a dead end for him. And I think Ron O'Neill's performance is pretty amazing here,
I agree,
actually, in that he lets this sorrow come through. You talk about the coats and the outfits he wears, and that's what we all remember, but he wears them like they weigh 1,000 pounds on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got the style and the strut with them, but at the same time, he walks around throughout this film bearing this load that he can't get out of this business. And that's how he plays every scene, even the sex scenes. He's distracted during them and not really, you know, focusing on what you think a movie is going to allow this scene to focus on. He can't do it because he's constantly thinking about how can he get out of this business and find a true independent life.
That's a great connection you make between the Curtis Mayfield soundtrack and the movie, because you're right. The Mayfield score is very upbeat. It's got a great tempo. You could walk into a club and hear it and want to dance to it, or you could also just sit back and not move at all and listen to it and take it very seriously and hear how plaintive
and that's
and
how it works
it
in the context of the movie.
That's how it works in the context of the film, and it does sum up the entire film where, yes, certain audience members could watch it and embrace just the lifestyle and see the cool car and the hats and the clothes, or you could really see what it seems Gordon Parks Jr. here as the director is really wanting to explore. And we spent so much time with Shaft talking about that great opening sequence. I think you have to mention it here. It's not an accident that you've got Gordon Parks Sr.'s son directing this movie. And this movie opens just like Shaft,
yep,
with an aerial shot zooming in on a character, in this case, two characters, on the street. But unlike Shaft, we only hear a little bit of the music. It isn't that pounding, pulsating Isaac Hayes. We hear the Curtis Mayfield just starting to come up a little bit. The first thing we actually hear, and it's perfect for the film, is we hear these two junkies on the street, and one of them says, "You get the money? I ain't got nothing. She wouldn't give it to me." That tells you right away you're watching a completely different type of film than what we saw with Shaft, where Richard Roundtree is strutting down the street, going past those theater marquees, showing us a new type of Hollywood hero. There's no glamour here. The stores are Wilbur's wigs, wholesale cigars, dilapidated buildings everywhere.
It's a totally different street.
It is, and you really got the sense watching Shaft that he was the king of New York. Priest here seems to be the king of the underworld New York, and it is worth noting that we don't see him for the first 3 or 4 minutes of this film. We see these two characters, and then we see where they connect later. But these characters are his minions. These are the people that are sprung out of the line of work he's in, and I love that kind of thoughtfulness that we see right away from this film.
The opening scene of Shaft is all about confidence, and the opening here is all about desperation.
You got it.
You mentioned Gordon Parks Jr., and I want to spend some time talking a little bit about the still photo sequence that I think is really the crucial sequence here for Superfly, especially in terms of setting it apart from Shaft. It's basically 8 minutes of a series of still photographs that trace Priest purchasing this huge amount of cocaine and then his employees cutting it up for sale, then going out on the street, selling it. Notably, not just in the neighborhood, but it traces it all the way to the white purchasers.
Yeah,
there's
a construction worker,
and then some sort of white-collar guy, mm-hmm. and follows through to them enjoying it as well. And we get this whole sense of the business that Priest is involved in with these really striking still photographs that Gordon Parks Jr. took. And it reminded me of nothing less than Steven Soderbergh's Traffic. I felt like I had just seen Traffic in 8 minutes, essentially. It's really an amazing sequence.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about the 1972 blaxploitation classic Superfly. It's part of our ongoing blaxploitation marathon. I love your take on that 8 minute sequence, and I think ultimately you're right, especially having rewatched it today. But I have to admit that the first time I saw it, as much as I loved the music, because I'll watch anything, literally anything, set to Curtis Mayfield's Pusher Man. It's that good. But my first instinct watching it was, it seemed to me a little bit like filler. It seemed to me like Parks Jr. didn't have enough material. It's already a fairly short film, right around 90 minutes. There's a love scene as well earlier in the film that's in a bathtub, where I applaud the fact that he's trying something grittier and trying something much more artistic than the love scenes or any scene we see in Shaft. But the audio that seems to be in real time, juxtaposed with these slow motion gauzy images of their bodies in the tub, isn't really interesting to me at all. And that too felt like a case where maybe Gordon Parks was trying to elongate this a little bit to stretch this movie out. But I'm saying I was wrong. If you watch it again, as I did, you do recognize how it traces that sale from the beginning on through to the end. And you really see how far this drug business goes. So I embrace that sequence, but I'm just confessing that the first time I saw it, I thought, okay, this is a really cool little bit that you added maybe to stretch this film out. I don't really think that's true. So
okay, good. Well, then let me defend the bathtub scene actually as well, because there is a wooziness to that scene that I can't think of any other similar type scene a movie has had. And I love where it comes to an end. First of all, it's an important scene on its own because Priest again is distracted at the beginning of that scene where they're in the bathtub. And the way it brings them around to show that they have a different relationship than these other women he's involved in. Mm-hmm. That's key in him playing out his plan to get out of the business.
True.
So there's value in that. But then it proceeds to have this sort of slow motion you mentioned with the music and this wooziness. And bang, it cuts right out of that to this fight scene on the street that is such a juxtaposition that I think those work so well to remind us of we're still in mm-hmm. this ghetto where this is all going on.
That's a great point, but I'd actually argue that the real bravura sequence in this movie is one that stands out because of its simplicity, and it's because of what we're talking about with some of these more artistic flourishes, but it's a scene between Priest, his partner played by Carl Lee, and the character named Scatter, who is the guy who got him started in the business. He's really what Priest is probably going to become and sees himself becoming, and he doesn't want to be that guy who's working as a chef in a restaurant and is trying to get out of the business and is old and tired, and he wants to avoid that and live the life that he thinks he's maybe entitled to or deserves. And they're in the back of this restaurant. I think it's 6 minutes or so total, and it's just really well cut. emphasizes all the right beats, doesn't have a ton of cutting in it. But then the last 2.5 minutes or so of the sequence is just a single shot. It's a three shot of those characters, and we just get to watch all the drama play out in front of us. No soundtrack, like I said, no other flourishes, no cuts, just the human drama, Youngblood, his partner, and as I said, the man he respects but doesn't want to become. And when Gordon Parks does that, when he restrains himself and allows the camera just to show those three in that conversation, you know that conversation is a crucial one to this film, and it really is. You know that it's determining his entire future from there.
Yeah, that's Julius Harris who plays Scatter, and that's a really good performance, too. You're right. That is a crucial scene because of all the different power dynamics mm-hmm. that are going on in what is essentially a business deal that Priest is trying to negotiate. So, yeah, this is a rich movie in its more ostentatious elements, but also those quieter ones, like you mentioned.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Hallgren. With Adam and Josh off this week, we're revisiting some highlights from their 2012 Blaxploitation Marathon. They followed the superlative Superfly with a bit of a letdown, 1973's Coffee, starring Pam Grier. After that, Black Caesar, another film with a killer soundtrack, that one by James Brown, and a terrific lead performance by Fred Williamson as the ruthless gangster Tommy Gibbs. Then, to Chicago for 1975's Coolie High. Here's Adam and Josh.
Has anybody heard Preacher's Poetry?
No, not me.
Your eyes are like limpid pools of eternity swallowing up my soul. No, man, wait a minute. There's more. Check this out. Liquid dreams and vision of you beckon to my throbbing manhood.
Copy that out of my notebook. What you doing going in my notebook?
That's Glenn Turman, the aspiring poet Preach, along with an ensemble cast there, his crew headed up by Lawrence Hilton Jacobs. You may know him as Freddie Boom Boom Washington from Welcome Back, Kotter. His nickname here is Cochise. The movie is Coolie High. It's the fifth film in our Blaxploitation Marathon. And Josh, another departure for us. All of these films have been in either New York City or Coffee, I believe, was set in L.A. It was certainly shot out in L.A. This is a movie shot and set right here in Chicago. And it's the first film in this marathon so far to not fundamentally be about crime. Crime plays a major role, but the characters are just high school students about to graduate, kind of figuring out what they want to do with their lives, like the film it was inspired by, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. It's not heavy on plot, it's more of a slice of life. I would also say that it's the lightest film overall in terms of the lack of overt racial commentary. There's the most humor and by far the least violence. I think so far, at least from our standpoint, this Blaxploitation Marathon has been very successful. We've seen some very interesting films, some very good films, and we had some help in this, as we mentioned at the start of it, a gentleman named Odie Henderson, who is more or less an expert on Blaxploitation. He loves these films, has a passion for it, has written about a lot of them. He helped guide us through our lineup and pick out the ones that really seem like a group of six films that were representative of the genre overall. And a few weeks ago when we were corresponding over email, he said that he's writing a book on Michael Schultz, who directed Coolie High, and it's a big expansion of the piece he wrote on his movies in 2008. And when he just recently revisited Coolie High, he had a really good experience with it. It was the first time he'd seen it since 1975, and it held up just as well. So with that, I wrote back to him and said, well, maybe you could help us out with Coolie High. How about you help set us up, give us something to consider and chew on with this film? And fortunately, Odie obliged.
Michael Schultz, this was his third theatrical feature. He had done some TV work before this, and it was supposed to be kind of the black answer to American Graffiti, which had come out 2 years prior. This is a coming-of-age story, just like American Graffiti, and it has a soundtrack of Motown classics as opposed to the doo-wop classics that filled George Lucas's movie. And it was written by Eric Monte, who created Good Times on television. In fact, Coolie High became a TV show of sorts when it turned into What's Happening on ABC a couple of years after that. And it has some interesting things in common with old teenager movies like Rebel Without a Cause. For example, they cast actors who are much older than the characters they're portraying. Glenn Turman, who plays the lead, was 30 practically when he made this picture. It also has a tragic aspect, like Rebel Without a Cause, that inspires the other teenagers, both in the movie and in the movie theater, to think and reconsider their lives and what they want to do with them. And so the question I have for you guys is, in watching the movie, did you feel that it was dated and cliched? I mean, we've seen this type of thing before and since. And I was wondering if you felt that way watching it from this vantage point of 2012 as opposed to 1975 when I saw it and everyone in my theater was crying and we thought the monkey poop scene was funny. I watched it recently and I still think it's funny. Did you guys think it was amusing as I did, or do I have a 5-year-old's mentality still?
Take this, you big, black, ugly gorilla.
Hey, man, what's wrong with you?
Man, don't be talking to no gorilla like that.
Oh, shit.
Hey, Mr. Gorilla, you gotta forgive these humans. They don't know how to act in front of no gorilla.
It's crazy, man.
Man, I don't believe you. Are you crazy?
See, you be nice to him, and he'll be nice to you.
Hey, look out, out, man.
Damn, man. Sure do stink.
You smell better now than you ever did.
Have a great show, and I look forward to listening to it. Peace.
Our thanks to Odie for that voicemail and his insights. His website is bigmediavandal.blogspot.com if you want to read more of his stuff. Josh, Odie's questions then go to you. Did this movie feel dated or cliched at all, and did you find it funny?
I don't know if I ever would find the gorilla poop scene funny, no matter what my age or when. But what I think it touches on and what this film is very strong in is capturing the camaraderie among these kids, mm-hmm. these friends who do live in this neighborhood dominated by public housing projects. And in that particular scene, it was great that this was set in Chicago and you could follow the neighborhoods and know where they were. And so this scene with the gorilla is Lincoln Park Zoo. So you see them getting out of their neighborhood and they're just kids up to no good, but not really up to anything too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a quality of so many good high school pictures. American Graffiti, obviously, Odie mentioned,
mm-hmm.
but also I thought of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, even something as recent.
Yeah, Cutting School and getting into trouble.
Something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World, too, from the last few years. They all have this youth energy to them and this sense of camaraderie, which was really strong. And I especially liked how it was a counterpoint to the grim reality that dominated these kids' lives in terms of the poverty in the neighborhood they're in, some of their home situations, the crime that's going around at the outskirts that threatens to suck them in.
Mm-hmm.
And they persevere through this with good humor. And I thought that carried over some of the broadness of the humor, maybe some of the broadness of the performances, though I do think Glenn Turman is really good in the lead role. So overall, I think this really works as an interesting, different look at the sorts of neighborhoods we've seen from a different perspective in the other blaxploitation mm-hmm. films.
I agree completely. I really enjoyed this film. And we got this voicemail from Odie after I'd seen it, and I didn't read anything about this film, as I've tried to avoid anything ahead of time with these films so far in the marathon. It's very clear, though, to anyone who's seen American Graffiti that that's what they're going for here. Right away, it seems like a black answer to that film, and a successful one. It's so clear, in fact, that I knew it was going to end with an epilogue, just as American Graffiti does, that fills us in on what happened to each character. I knew it was coming. Sure enough, I think it's even the same type in yellow lettering. At least that's how I remember it. You know, so-and-so went to Vietnam. This guy became a factory worker. I hated the tidiness of that epilogue in American Graffiti, and I didn't like it here. But that's maybe the only thing that I didn't really like about this movie. I think that an answer to Odie for me, how it's dated, if it feels dated at all, is just that we've now seen so many similar movies to it, not just American Graffiti and Rebel Without a Cause, as he mentioned, which are both movies that came out before and I saw before. Clearly, I saw Cooley High, but Boys in the Hood mm-hmm. is one I couldn't help but think about throughout this entire film. You know precisely where this movie is going once Cochise, the basketball star, finds out he's getting into gambling on a basketball scholarship. Right away, you know this probably isn't going to end well. It's not about a lack of suspense. That's not what this film really is. It's not about plot, as we mentioned. Just that emotional crush, maybe, of the tragic ending is limited, I think, because I knew it was coming. I was just waiting for it to come. It limits it, but not completely. I still think that closing sequence with Preach finally having the courage to speak his words, to read a poem he's written, is still very moving, especially after, in an earlier scene in the film, he recites someone else's poetry in a key scene where he's trying to seduce this attractive woman, Brenda. And actually what leads to the tragic downfall in the film is his lack of expression. If you think about it, it's a moment where he's supposed to say something to his friend and he's too hurt and he decides not to express it instead. So this whole idea of what you say and how you say it and expressing yourself is a big aspect of this film. It's a big part of growing up and deciding what you believe in and how you're going to show that to the world. So I thought that was a really nice touch. And the ending is, for me, it's not one that maybe reduced me to tears as it probably did a lot of people in 1975, probably just because of Boys in the Hood, but it was still very effective.
I ain't never read my poetry for nobody, not even my mama. It goes, we were friends a long time ago, laughing, rapping, chasing girls, obeying no laws except the one of caring. Basketball days and high nights, no tomorrows. Unable to remember yesterday. We live for today. Oh, man, it don't rhyme. Jeez. You could have been the greatest, man. You could have been.
That soliloquy scene is really strong at the end of the movie. It's quite moving. I think Boys in the Hood, this is definitely a precursor to Boys in the Hood in terms of plot mechanics, but also in the way it does allow tragedy to intrude on the story. This overall is much more of a comedy than Boys in the Hood. But in the way that tragedy comes in, I like how throughout the film we see, especially once Preach and Cochise make that choice to get in the stolen car with a couple of other kids, and it's for a joyride to them. These guys, you know, they're criminals, so this is what they do. But for Preach and Cochise, it's just a rash decision, a youthful decision. But the movie emphasizes what a thin line there is between making a decision like that and something like death or jail just because of where they live.
Yeah, there are consequences immediately attached to any mistake.
Any mistake that any other kid might make in any other neighborhood, but here it's really, it can have fatal results.
That's a great
point. The way the movie underlies that, I think, is really important. I also thought of another film that handles camaraderie and tragedy, Stand By Me. I wonder, too, if this might even have been an influence. Obviously, the King book is what's the clear influence, but that came to mind, too, just in terms of youth being this joyful and time of optimism, but there's tragedy underneath that, too. So, and I like the touch in this film that stood out to me. I don't know what other movie you might have this. I don't know how they chose to put it in here because it's such an aside. But again, it's that recognition of the reality these kids face within this comic, sometimes stereotypical story. It's when Preach comes home late and he's not supposed to be out. And then his mother, who I think references at one point that she works three jobs, comes home from the night shift and catches him, or she might want to reprimand him for something earlier he did. But at any rate, she tells him, go get the belt. You're going to get it.
Yeah.
Go get the belt. And then he goes upstairs. She sits down on a chair. And before he can come downstairs with the belt, she falls asleep. That was just such a moving moment to me. And then his reaction isn't, you know, to just run away like, oh, I got away with this one. He goes up to her, gives her a gentle kiss. And that was just like this brief aside that really brings home what these kids' lives are like.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the fifth of six movies in our Blaxploitation Marathon. It's Cooley High, a film that was shot and set here in Chicago, released in 1975. I like that you picked that scene because that's a key scene where you remember, I believe it's after she says, go get the belt, one of his lines to her that I don't think she even responds to, or actually I think it's maybe when he comes downstairs and finds her asleep. He says, hey, Mama, I'm 18 now. Maybe it's time I move out. It's this notion of him saying, I'm maybe a little bit too old for you to be getting the belt out on me, and it's time that I make my own decisions and live on my own. And I think that that really is one of the key themes here. I mean, it's obvious that this is a coming-of-age story. These men who are 18, they're leaving high school. They're sort of leaving this protected world and maybe even leaving the protected world of this neighborhood for some of them. But definitely that's a key theme here. And I think that, as I was saying with this idea of expression, I think that one of the key aspects to becoming an adult is the ability to express yourself honestly and with conviction. If you look at Preach in this movie, he is always lying. There's almost not a moment where he isn't lying to someone. He never accepts responsibility for anything. Everything has an excuse, and he really only starts to find his voice later. There's a scene in a bathroom where he's truthful with a teacher, played by Garrett Morris, Mr. Mason. He says, "What do you want? What can I do for you?" And I love this answer because it's complicated, and it doesn't seem to fit into this movie. He says, "I want to live forever."
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an abstract idea, but you think he means it. And of course, you can tie it into this notion of him wanting to be a poet, of him wanting to be a writer. One of the ways you live forever is to live on. You have your immortality through your words. So I really like that. And I think that it kind of hints at this fleetingness to life on the streets. That's kind of what he's battling against, is this notion that it can be taken away from you so easily. And there's a key part in that scene as well where Mr. Mason says to him something about having a lot of potential. "I see this kid with so much potential, and I just want to reach you and for you to fully realize it." And serendipitously, I was just wrapping up the last two episodes of the HBO series Tremé over the weekend. And that's the one show I make time for right now. I know, yes, I have a lot of TV shows to catch up on out there, but I've been watching Tremé. And there's a scene just like that in the penultimate episode where the assistant band teacher is talking to a student saying, "What's up? Can I help you out? You have so much potential." And she says, "Everybody has potential. All of my siblings, they all had potential too. We've all been hearing about potential for years, but look at what happened to them. None of them realized it. Why am I going to be any different than that?" So there's this notion of when and how does potential finally grow into something or become something tangible that these people can actually achieve.
So that goes back to Odie's question and at least placing it in retrospect. It's sort of sad that those sort of dramas and conversations in drama are still taking place mm-hmm. with kids like this, often in some of the same Chicago neighborhoods. And this film is filmed in what? Early 70s, set in 1964. And here we are decades later seeing the same dramas having mm-hmm. to be played out.
I'm glad you mentioned responding to seeing it as a Chicago film. And obviously we're going to do that as people who live here in Chicago. But I just think overall the use of environment is very effective. It makes their neighborhood a place that is both scary and also really comfortable, like I think it would be for these people who have only known this neighborhood. And for us, seeing Chicago, seeing Lincoln Park Zoo and the L and the buses in the different neighborhoods, it did really make me want to go back and redo my top five Chicago movies. I think Cooley High would be in contention.
Well, speaking of the Chicago setting, I like how they proceeded to the neighborhood where this takes place, which is supposed to be the Cabrini Green neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
We start out with a view from the lake of the familiar, beautiful Chicago skyline. And then as the credits proceed, we move further inward, further west, mm-hmm. away from all of the tourist areas,
right,
till we get into this neighborhood. So right at the start, I like how Schultz moves us forward to the context where he wants us mm-hmm. to be, the neighborhood he wants us to be in.
And we talked about the emotional impact of the end scene of this film. It doesn't hurt that the soundtrack throughout the film is amazing, all these Motown classic tunes, but you get this original song, I believe, for the movie, It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday, that Boys to Men ended up redoing in the 90s and making really popular. And I'm sure you remember the name of Boys to Men's first album, Josh.
Boys to Men's first album would be, no, I don't.
Cooley High Harmony.
Oh, that's right. That's familiar,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, Cooley High
that?
Harmony, and they covered this tune. It's a great song, and it really does make that ending very powerful.
I thought we'd get to see forever, but forever has flown away. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
When we come back, best picture, best soundtrack, best sticking it to the man moment. It's the Mayfields. Adam and Josh hand out the Blaxploitation Marathon Awards when Film Spotting returns. Stay with us.
Yeah, man, like you know.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, filling in for Adam and Josh this week. I'm Sam Van Halgren, the godfather of soul, the hardest working man in show business, Mr. James Brown, of course. That song, Down and Out in New York City, from his soundtrack to 1973's Black Caesar, the fourth film in Film Spotting's 2012 Blaxploitation Marathon. We're going to wrap up the special edition of the show with the Mayfields, the Blaxploitation Marathon Awards. And as the name suggests, being a nod to Curtis Mayfield, among the highlights of the marathon was the music, made by some of the most creative musical minds of the 1970s. Isaac Hayes' soundtrack to Shaft, Mayfield's to Superfly, James Brown's to Black Caesar, and the Chicago-based Cooley High, which featured a memorable set of Motown songs. Perhaps not a coincidence that the two remaining films in the six-part series, the Pam Grier starring Coffee and the trippy horror film Ganja and Hess, were the films Adam and Josh liked the least. They also had the least compelling music. Apologies to any Roy Ayers fans out there. Let's get back to Adam and Josh for The Mayfields. It is dead. That's what I said. Let the man rap a plan, said he'd send him home. But his hope wasn't right, and he should have known. It's hard to understand. There was love in this man. Let's start with, fittingly, best music, best soundtrack. Where do you go?
I could easily have given it to any of these three. You've got Shaft with Isaac Hayes' Oscar-winning title song. Superfly, just heard Curtis Mayfield. I love how he underlines each groove with an element of sadness. Or Black Caesar by James Brown. And I'm going to go with Black Caesar, actually. Paid the cost to be the boss. Paid the cost to be the boss. I paid the cost to be the boss. Look at me. You know what to see. I think his soundtrack is thematically of a piece like the others. That line, paid the cost to be the boss, that pretty much sums up the entire film. And also, I'm just a sucker for James Brown's music. I mean, I appreciate Hayes and Mayfield, but Brown's records are the ones I have at home.
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of the ones I was really wrestling with here. I went in a different direction, but I love James Brown's music in Black Caesar. You could give it, I suppose, even though it's not original music, you could give a best soundtrack to Cooley High in its appropriation of Motown. I do love how music is used there. And Isaac Hayes and Shaft, come on, it's hard to beat that. But I do think that Curtis Mayfield beats it with Superfly. Not only Pusher Man, but the song Superfly. Those songs are just enduring classics, and I think sum up this genre on so many levels. So I was the one who wanted to call this award segment originally The Mayfields because I love those songs so much. It had to be my choice for best soundtrack. What about best supporting performance? We have a lot of very notable lead performers throughout this genre. We'll get to some of those names in a moment, but what about some of the lesser known characters?
I went with Carl Lee as Eddie in Superfly. Eddie is the partner of Priest, the drug dealer who serves as the main character, and he's sort of the devil on Priest's shoulder, you could say. He always pulls Priest back in whenever he suggests that he might want to get out of this business. And Lee is very smooth and snaky in this role. You never trust him, but he does seem to make sense, especially when he's selling the myth that this life of crime is all that he and Priest know how to live. It's all they know how to do.
Are you going to give all this up? 8-track stereo, color TV in every room, and can snort a half a piece of dope every day. That's the American dream, nigga. Well, ain't it? Ain't it? You better come on in, man.
Of course, the movie overall is a retort to that thinking, but Eddie does make for an awfully convincing foil.
Yeah, he's really good. I definitely considered Carl Lee from Superfly. I also considered Julius Harris as Scatter from Superfly.
Yeah.
There's a great scene between Carl Lee and Julius Harris and Ron O'Neill, the lead in Superfly, that we talked about during the show in the back of his restaurant. Also, I thought about Charles Cioffi as Vic Andrazzi, the cop from Shaft. He's a lot of fun to watch. Booker Bradshaw as the bad guy in Coffee is another one. But I had to go with the real villain for me of the entire Blaxploitation Marathon. It was Art Lund as McKinney from the film Black Caesar.
My shoes are all scuffed. You shine them up for me, boy, like you used to. you kneel down here. Shine them real good. I want to see my face in them. I'm in a real hurry, so you shine them up fast.
That guy is just so fun to hate in this movie. From our first exposure to him, where he sees the young Fred Williamson character as a boy, probably only 10, 11, 12 years old, and accuses him of stealing $50 from him or shorting him on what he had coming to him, and then savagely beats him and leaves him crippled for the rest of his life. And then he comes back or remains an antagonist to our protagonist throughout the rest of the film. And it's unfortunate that his undoing, his comeuppance, has to come at the expense of our hero as well. There's no real moment of glory where we just get to see the black character take down the bad white guy, because there's a tragic downfall element to his character as well. But he's a really scary, really bad character, and I like Art Lund's performance a lot in Black Caesar. What about best lead performance? And I suppose, although we've listed some of the names, we should review them real quick. The star of Shaft, Richard Roundtree. Ron O'Neill as Priest from Superfly. We had Pam Grier, we're including her in the mix, of course, you have to, as Coffee. Black Caesar starred Fred Williamson. Cooley High had more of an ensemble, but I think you could look to Preacher and Glenn Turman as the star of that film. And then finally with Ganja and Hess, we talked about Dwayne Jones a little bit. So who are you giving your award for the best lead performance?
I thought about Glenn Turman, actually, because
yeah,
I think that was a really affecting performance he gave. But I did end up going with Ron O'Neill, who's just so sorrowful as Priest in Superfly, this New York City cocaine dealer who lives the high life, this life of crime and wealth, but he still walks around with these really heavy shoulders. And it's not guilt exactly that's bothering him. It's just this growing realization that the one thing his money hasn't been able to buy is his independence.
What do you do when you get out?
I don't know. Not so much for what we do. It's having a choice. Being able to decide what it is I want. Not just to be forced into a thing, because that's the way it is. Well, buy me some time, baby. Some time that isn't all f***ed up with things we gotta do. Just to be free.
And will that make you happy?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know I can't be happy the way it is now.
O'Neill infuses this performance with a restless dissatisfaction that you can detect. He's even distracted during the sex scenes, and when he snorts his own product, you can tell he's doing it to gain confidence for this business that he's trying to conduct. The movie and this performance really eat away at the entire pimp as God persona, mm-hmm. which is also what the entire film does.
Yeah, I think I can't say it any better. Ron O'Neill was also my choice
okay.
as the lead in Superfly for our best lead performance in the Blaxploitation Marathon. That brings us to best moment or scene. What stands out for you?
I'm going to stick with Superfly, and it's that still photo sequence that we talked about, which is a little jarring initially because it seems to come out of nowhere, but it's a series of still photographs given different places in the frame. Sometimes there's about four of them that we see at once, and they trace the cocaine from its procurement to its packaging to its sale, and we travel from the ghetto all the way to the upper-class white clients who make up a significant part of Priest's client base. We have Mayfield's music as the backdrop, and director Gordon Parks Jr. took the photos. When we reviewed the film, I compared it to Steven Soderbergh's Traffic in 8 Minutes because mm-hmm. of the way it follows the chain of the drug trade. And it really does open up the story, this little section, so that we see it as something that affects all of society, not just this one bad neighborhood.
Ain't I clean, bad machine, super cool, super mean, feeling good for the man, super fly, here I stand, secret stash, heavy bread, baddest bitches in the bed.
Yeah, I think your Traffic in 8 Minutes summary almost convinced me that that was the scene of the marathon, but I ended up having to go with Isaac Hayes and Richard Roundtree and Gordon Parks Sr. and the opening credits, the opening scenes to Shaft.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Oh, I love that too.
Our first exposure to Blaxploitation as this marathon commenced, it's what started our first film, but it was also the start of Blaxploitation for a lot of people on a little bit more of a mainstream level. Obviously, some people were seeing Sweet Sweet Back and the Melvin Van Peebles films, but this was Blaxploitation really getting on a larger stage. And not only the music, but what it says about the Shaft character, how he's kind of this king of New York City, this black king of New York City. He seems to own the streets and everyone makes way for him. And when a car does get too close to him and almost hits him, he gives it right back to him and suggests what they can do with themselves. And I love that he seems to be this real man of the people. It sets up really everything you need to know about who Shaft is in those opening scenes. But more importantly, as we touched on during our discussion, coming across those theater marquees, there's a clear implication by Gordon Parks Sr. that this is your new black hero. This guy has come along to replace Robert Redford and some of these other guys that white America is enjoying going into the cinema and watch at this time. Here's someone for you, he seems to be saying. So with all that, I had to go with the opening scene and the opening credit sequence to Shaft. We also thought we would throw in a fun one here that just relates specifically to this marathon. I'm not sure that you could apply it to any other marathon. It's the best sticking it to the man scene.
We couldn't have done this with Brisson?
No. No, I don't think we could. Best sticking it to God scene?
There you go.
Maybe.
All right, sticking it to the man. Well, we both had our problems with coffee, especially the way it simultaneously celebrates coffee's independence while objectifying her. And I particularly noted how I was underwhelmed by Greer's performance here, at least compared to what I was expecting. She was struggling to define her persona beneath all that objectification. Yet, I do think that Coffee's final confrontation with the boyfriend who had been using her and betraying her throughout the film, I think it has that raw, righteous power that Greer would eventually draw on and claim and would use to create the persona that we now know. It's where you see Pam Greer being born in a lot of ways. So even though it's in a movie that's not successful overall, it's going to be my sticking it to the man scene.
I love that choice because I didn't even consider it. And the reason why is not only did I kind of dismiss Coffee as you did, but I was thinking it had to be a scene where the black character was sticking it to the white man.
Yeah, I
but
know.
Here
I
we
thought
go
about that
full
too.
Circle now back to Django Unchained.
Little
on
bit.
On some level. And he's another character. It's a black man, but someone who has completely sold out his people and has become the man or has done everything he can, and there are terrible consequences to his actions, to become like the establishment. And so that's a really, really interesting choice. I like it a lot. For me, I'm going back to Black Caesar, and I regret that I wasn't able to rewatch the scene. I just didn't have time before we sat down here, and I did want to get some of the specifics of the scene. But as I recall it, it's the scene with my favorite villain, my favorite supporting performer, Art Lund, McKinney, in Black Caesar, where he's sitting at a table at a house, like in a basement, and Fred Williamson goes to have a conversation with him and basically says, I'm part of you now. I'm part of this mafia. I've joined the club, so to speak. And he says, there's no way these people are ever going to allow a black man. And of course, that's not how he said it, but they're never going to allow you into this club. And he says, oh, really? And basically walks them downstairs. And they say, yeah, he's one
good
of us
scene.
Now.
I
he
like
gets
that
to
one.
Really stick it to the guy who has been his nemesis his
Since
entire life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he gets to say, you know what? Now I'm in charge here. I have some power now. And what you thought was unthinkable before has now become a reality. So that's my favorite sticking it to the man scene. And that brings us to Best Picture. What was your favorite film of the six we watched, Josh?
It was pretty clear for me, even though I really liked a lot of these. I went with Superfly. It just shocked me the way Superfly is the antithesis of what the common pop cultural perception of the pimp dealer figure is. It's not this noble stud criminal that's putting one over on the man. That's sort of been fed to us by crime glorifying gangster rap or unenlightened hood movies. This instead is a portrait of crime as a form of it's sort of a spiritual prison that Priest is in, and it's almost always going to lead to a literal prison is the sense you get from this movie. I think it's a really daring movie, even if it's one whose meaning unfortunately seems to have been lost on some generations that have followed it. It's just a real delight to encounter this film.
Yeah, I went with Superfly as well for my Best Picture, and I could see some people taking issue with that choice in that it may not live up to the expectation of blaxploitation in terms of being more of a romp, being more of a good time, really reveling in the exploitation as some of the films, Coffee, for example, does, and maybe being too pretentious, trying to have its cake and eat it too, trying to have some of that pimp element to it and the crime and the drugs and the white women and all the luxury that his character has, while at the same time condemning it and saying, I don't want this anymore. So if people do have that objection, that's fine. But for me, the combination of the things we've touched on, the music, the Ron O'Neill performance, all of those blaxploitation elements, but then having a conscience about it and trying to say something profound beyond just the entertainment value of now we've empowered a black man and he's going to stick it to the bad white people. That is subversive and valuable in its own right, but sure. I love the fact that there is also this element of social commentary where you have a character saying, you know what, I'm doing everything I thought I was supposed to do. I've got all these things that are supposed to make me happy, and I'm realizing that what I don't have is my freedom. I don't have the right to do whatever I want to do. I'm still locked into this prison. So there is some substance in addition to the style that I certainly did not expect when I went into the movie Superfly. I knew the music, I knew the name, I knew some of the tropes of the film, but that was it. And then I was really taken by surprise, as you were, I think, by really what was being said, what messages were being imparted in that movie as well. So Superfly, also my standout film. But I considered Shaft, I considered Cooley High. For me, though, I think Superfly is the one that I'm far from an expert on blaxploitation, having only seen six films. But if someone came to me and said, where do I start? I can only watch one. I'd say Superfly.
Yeah, probably. Where would I start? Maybe Shaft, but the yes. best Superfly.
You heard it. Want to start your own blaxploitation marathon? Start with Shaft. But if you're just looking for something to watch this weekend, Superfly. Yes, I'm your pusher man. More information about blaxploitation and all the film spotting marathons can be found at filmspotting.net. Just look for the marathons tab at the top of the page. We've done nearly 30 of them going back to 2005. You can even get a head start on the next scheduled marathon, Korean Auteurs, coming in September of this year. Opening in limited release here in Chicago this weekend, comedian Kevin Hart has a new concert special opening in theaters, Kevin Hart, Let Me Explain. Also, the new doc, How to Make Money Selling Drugs, which is pretty much exactly as the title explains, featuring interviews with drug dealers, prison employees, and lobbyists arguing for tougher drug laws. Actually, no, Adam recently caught up with this one and gave it a positive review on the Letterboxd site. You can check that out at letterboxd.com/filmspotting. Also in limited release, the latest from Pedro Almodovar, I'm So Excited, and that's the name of the movie, though I am also excited about new Almodovar. Also an adaptation of Salman Rushdie's award-winning novel, Midnight's Children. And finally, The Way, Way Back, a kind of teen coming-of-age story with just a stellar cast, Sam Rockwell, Steve Carell, Toni Collette, and Allison Janney. In wide release, more Steve Carell, animated this time in Despicable Me 2, and Johnny Depp is Tonto in The Lone Ranger. Next week, Adam and Josh and I think special guest Michael Phillips will be naming their best movies of the year so far, so please join us next week for that. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and myself. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.